We design devices so that the cop lives inside them. And so the device is designed to be tamper-resistant, tamper-evident, and to enforce policy against its owner's wishes.
That's the fetus beat.
The prolific author, blogger, and copyright provocateur Cory Doctorow is something of an anomaly in the publishing world. He is the author of some of the most popular sci-fi books in recent history, including Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, Little Brother, and Makers, just released last month. While you'll probably be able to find Makers and Cory's other books at the most popular bookstores in the nation, you can also find most of his novels and nonfiction books on the web as free digital downloads. Not only free as in free beer, but under a Creative Commons license, so you can feel free to download, remix, and redistribute. While some in the industry say free downloads kill profits, encourage piracy, and destroy respect for copyright, Cory effectively says, bring it on. So it may have caught some of Cory's followers by surprise when he actually came out in support of copyright at the National Reading Summit in Toronto last week. Wait, was he actually supporting the arguments of publishers who fear the death of their industry at the hands of millions of file-sharing bibliophiles? But while many in the publishing industry might argue for copyright restrictions to protect the future of the book from download-happy readers, Cory is actually arguing for copyright as a means of protecting the future of books from the hands of overly litigious publishers. There's a distinction, he says, between the kind of licensing that publishers use to prevent readers from sharing, copying, or even permanently owning a text, and the view of copyright that would actually safeguard the rights of the reader. And what we learn from the publishing industry in this space can actually be used in film, music, software, and any other kind of digital media. David Weinberger recently sat down with Cory Doctorow to talk about copyright in the publishing industry and the wonderful culture of the book. The interview was so fascinating, we decided we couldn't cut any of it this week. So settle in and enjoy.
So Cory, you of all people are going around telling people to respect copyright?
Yeah, specifically I'm telling publishers to respect copyright. No one reads 17 U.S.C., which is the copyright statute. I actually had a little word count of it yesterday and realized it was something like 180,000 words. But if you are to summarize 17 U.S.C., you would say that it gives some rights to rights holders and it gives some rights to the public, and it balances those out as the result of a long sausage-making exercise that's been going on since the Constitution was drafted and the Progress Clause was written. And one thing about it you can say, whether you like it or you hate it, is that it represents a law written by the people's representatives. Maybe tainted by lobbying, maybe grown old and crufty, but a law. Now, if you go out and you buy an electronically delivered book, or other media too, music and videos and so on, but I think books are different. After a long kind of struggle with this, I've decided that it's okay to reify books, because books are actually old and important in a way that music and videos and video games aren't. Books are like older, not just than copyright, and not just than publishing, but than printing, right? I mean, books are really, really old. All the other media are kind of descended from books in that sense. So books in copyright have always had, there's always been this notion that you own books, right? When you buy a book, you own a book. You can sell the book, you can lend the book, you can give the book away. You have rights to the book. You are a book's owner. You can put it in your library. The acquisition of a library is thought of as one of the great goods of society, either on a personal or a social level. Thomas Jefferson, of course, donated his library to the American people and created the Library of Congress.
By the way, after the Canadians burned it down.
That's right.
But
yeah.
We're over that.
You know that song, The Arrogant Worms and the White House burned, and we're the ones that did it. So this is an important feature of copyright law, in my view. It's in terms of books, I think it may be the most important feature of copyright laws is safeguarding the right of people to own books. Buy a digitally delivered book today, and you will find that it comes wrapped in an incredibly large amount of licensing terms. If you buy an audiobook, digitally delivered audiobook through Audible, through iTunes, through an iPhone, collectively it's something like 26,000 words of user license agreement in it. That's not 180,000 words of 17 USC, but it's a lot of EULA. And that EULA is not there for your benefit. No one writes a 26,000 word license to give you more rights. You could write a EULA for Audible that, or for any digitally delivered work that respected copyright, it would be four words long. It would say, don't violate copyright law, right? And you'd be punting to a judge to decide what was and wasn't a permissible use, right? Instead of saying, I take it on my own board as a corporate lawyer to tell you what copyright law says you can and can't do, I do it here. What's happening is that these publishers are declaring that by fiat, because they're delivering it over a modem instead of through a retailer, that they get to demote you from a book's owner who has the full weight of copyright law behind your claim of ownership to a mere user, a licensor, a kind of wormy supplicant who is being given a crumb of rights to the book. And that crumb is constrained by the most abusive legalese in operation today. And I want publishers to respect copyright. I want publishers to respect the rights that Congress and parliaments and WIPO and the Berne Convention and the WIPO copyright treaties and the TRIPS, the rights that we get under those rules that say we can own libraries like Thomas Jefferson owned his library. Maybe the Canadians won't burn it down this time around. But I think that's an important message. I think that in all this business about property and stealing, you know, here we have not like a metaphor about property, like I have a metaphorical property interest in my intellectual property, but an actual physical piece of property, an actual physical book. And publishers are enthusiastically telling us that we don't own it, that our property rights don't matter for shit. And I really want property rights to be restored to books.
Isn't this an economic model question, not a legal question? Because they're within their legal rights to license something that you used to buy. So, but they have a strong economic business interest in not doing so.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. Actually, it's quite an advantage in talking about copyright law not to be a lawyer, because they get lost in the weeds, in my experience. But I would say that to the extent that copyright in the Anglo-American tradition is instrumental, and specifically in the American tradition is constitutionally framed, that copyright has a goal, and that goal is to promote useful arts and sciences, and that there is such a thing as abusing copyright. So, for example, what if the license to a copyrighted work said, you agree to treat this work in copyright for 400 years? Right, as though it's in copyright for 400 years. So even if it enters the public domain next week, you have to keep it in copyright for 400 years. I think most courts would say that that's not a valid license agreement, right? Because the purpose of copyright is to give you life in 70 years or 95 years in the case of a work made for hire, not to give you 400 years extensible by merely adding a license term and then binding people to it by adhesion, right? There are a lot of things you can't contract into or out of. You can't contract out, in some cases, you can't contract out of health and safety rules, right? You can't say to someone who is going to work for you that you agree that by working for me, you won't sue me if it turns out that I'm asking you to work in ankle-deep water with electrical wires dangling near it, right? That life, even if it's entered into freely, it's not something we can contract into or out of, because there's a reason for that rule. And the rules in copyright have a reason. One of those reasons is to preserve ownership. So you can license anything, right? You can license soup. So if you bought a bowl of soup, and when you got to the bottom of the bowl, it said, by eating the soup, you've agreed that you wouldn't share it with your neighbor, and you wouldn't take it home, and you wouldn't try to replicate its flavor in your own soup creations in the future. And I think that, you know, courts would laugh at it, right? It just doesn't pass the giggle test. And I think that you actually can see when you look at these licenses closely that they don't pass the giggle test either, because they always have this clause that says if any portion of this license is found to be unenforceable, the remainder will still stay in force, which is really like a corporate lawyer's way of saying, this is not limited to the stuff that we think is legal. We put in everything, and you can sue us and spend the money to figure out which parts we mean and which parts we don't. And I don't think that that's a fair business practice. Like, I think that there's a strong policy interest, a trade policy interest in ensuring that kind of practice isn't taken seriously in the courts. I mean, otherwise, why not just say, by coming into my hotel room to record this podcast, you've agreed that I'm allowed to go through your wallet, right? I mean, that's just not conscionable.
Well, let's go back to the giggle test. Mm-hmm. We have generally become acculturated to end user licenses, and starting mainly with software. Mm-hmm. The software came with the shrink wrap that you had to open. By opening the shrink wrap, you wrap your committing yourself to a contract you undoubtedly have not read.
Which of the courts have already shot down, right? And the most recently with Autodesk, where they said, you've agreed that this isn't a sale. By breaking the shrink wrap, you agree that you didn't buy this, you licensed it. And someone went off and sold it and said, well, I bought it, it's mine. And they said, no, you didn't. The license says that you didn't buy it. And the court said, no, he did. Right? He has a bill of sale. He did. Doesn't matter what you said in the EULA.
So there's the issue of whether opening shrink wrap commits you to a contract. But put that aside, because now we have 26,000 words of end user license agreements, EULAs, for digital books and reading material. That stuff is there. It generally puts it in front of you and says, accept or not. Nobody reads it, of course, but we accept. So, that's past the problem of accepting a license just by opening it. We are now so acculturated to end-user licenses, starting with software, that the notion of downloading and reading something with a set of terms that prevent you contractually from reselling it and so forth, that does pass the giggle test. I mean, you say that to someone, and you've got lots of people who are doing lots of digital downloading who do it every day, read those terms, agree to them without giggling. So have we gone too far?
I don't necessarily buy that premise, but I think if it's true, it's bad news for publishing, right? Because I think publishing gets a free ride on the penumbra of virtue that surrounds books, and that penumbra is centered on the idea of owning books and the historicity of books and the longevity of books and the posterity of books. And so, you know, like I always say, if you want to make a short film and you want to illustrate society in ruins, cut to a scene of a pile of books burning. Right, and we'll all know exactly what that means. Totalitarianism has risen. There is no hope. Right? I once had a fiction editor tell me that if you wanted to make a character more sympathetic, point out that she goes to the library and owns a lot of books. Right, and everybody reading it will go, oh, right. So there are these elements there, right, of virtue, and that sells books. Right? It makes people happier to own books because books, as I say, are different. Books aren't software. Books are like dogs, right? We have this like species deep relationship with them, right? Like dogs exist because, you know, we bred them to be like us and they bred us to be like them. And we've had, you know, we have this millennia history with dogs, and we don't eat dogs for like lots of sentimental reasons. And we don't burn books for lots of sentimental reasons. I used to work in a bookstore, and when I was stripping the paperbacks to send them back to the publisher, it hurt. Right? I can barely recycle the phone book, right? I mean, you know, so that penumbra of virtue is a free ride publishing gets, because having worked in a bookstore, I'm today a bookseller. I mean, through Boing Boing, I sell 25,000 books a year through my Amazon link. I write books, I publish books, I have an imprint, I edit. I mean, I do. I am involved in the whole vertical bookstore,
vertically
integrated bookman, and I really think that books are actually not as good as their penumbra would have you believe it. I mean, there's a lot of bad books out there. There's a lot of books that don't deserve that sentimental heart tug when we tear the cover off of them. There's a lot of books that, you know, you could burn on a cold winter's day without humanity losing anything of much import. And yet, I emotionally have a hard time breaking with that. Now, if you actually do convince people that books are just a thing like software, we're going to start cooking and eating our books, right? We're going to start treating it as disposable and unimportant and optional and unworthy as code, right? And I think publishing loses something if they do that. I mean, they're trying to cut their own throats by doing this.
But isn't that exactly what's happening? Not only publishers cutting their own throats, but books, when they become digitized, don't feel like possessions that you own. I mean, literally feel. I'm not making a legal judgment here. I'm just saying... Uh-huh. You know, it's just it's another thing that crosses through a screen and that you may or may not want to get to. But if you do, you're going to use the electronic means of downloading again. It doesn't have the feel of an object that you want to hold on to. And the form of the book, many of those books that you're advocating burning, because that's going to be the headline of this, of course, are books that don't have all that much value because they insisted on being inflated to a book size. They really should have been something shorter, or they should have been disconnected, not connected. And so the hyperlinking of books is dissolving, in many cases, the form of books as well as their substance. And if that's the case, then the historical attachment that we have to books may just be, you know, historical, becoming historical.
Well, so I don't know that that's true, right? Like, I think that that I love my collections of digital material, partly because it's so easy to get a piece of digital material that once you've collected it and curated it and rated it and folded it and filed it and put it somewhere, and also, you know, if you're like me and you upgrade machines a lot, once you've watched the progress bar as it zipped from an old hard drive to a new hard drive enough times, it starts to feel like one of those books that you've packed and unpacked in a box a lot of times as you've moved around the world, right? I think you're right that it does make it more fragile. It makes that relationship more fragile, which is all the more reason for publishers to be trying to figure out how to restore that emotional connection rather than trying to weaken it. And actually, you know, if you go to like Frankfurt Book Fair or the London Book Fair or whatever, there's like an infinite number of kind of gassy presentations from marketing consultants explaining how to create a retail experience around books online, right? And like, I keep getting shown like ebook readers that do things like they're bound in leather, or there's an animation of a page turn when you click next page, right? And this is like a cargo cult approach to the experience of books, right? Because for me, you know, some of my like key emotional experience of books have been things like reading my dad's books and seeing his notes in the margin and then thinking someday my kid will read them. Or buying a book and putting it on my shelf and thinking someday my kid will own this book, right? Or taking a book and giving it to a friend and then later seeing it on her shelf or his shelf. I mean, all of those things are part of that ownership, that part of that emotional connection. And that could be conveyed digitally as well as physically just as well. It could be on your library thing shelf just as readily as it's on your bookshelf. And, you know, you do get books like this, right? Like, you always know who your friends are because they've got O'Reilly books on the shelves, right? You can always tell a good hackerspace. It's got a copy of Applied Cryptography. You know, little ego boo. I once went and visited Disney in Burbank, and a friend who worked there had a copy of Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, my book about Disney World, on the shelf. And I said, oh, look, you got a copy of Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom. And he said, yeah, it's how we can tell who's a cool Disney exec if they've got a copy of that, right? I mean, they're signifiers. They do all this good stuff, right?
So you, first of all, you've dismissed the aspects of books that many book lovers or perhaps book fetishists take as primary. They'll talk about opening the smell of the must and the feel of the leather and all that. So you put that to one side, and you've now pointed to another set of attributes of books that are really important to you and I think to many of us. And I think the question is, which of those attributes would preserve the historically important aspects of books? B, which of those will be replaced by, or substituted by digitally? For example, seeing what's on somebody else's digital bookshelf, well, social networking of books, sites like Library Thing let you do that. And C, which one of those we ought to be allowed to barter away? So, for example, suppose a publisher were to say, you can license our book, and we'll give you, it's going to cost less if you give up the right to
read it
pass it
on.
No, well, no, pass it along to your...
But why not read it on Wednesdays?
Well,
really?
But because I get to make up the example.
Okay.
All right, so this is a much more reasonable thing. We'll give you a read once license, and we'll charge you half or whatever. That mm-hmm. If you want to keep it perpetually, then you can have it, and you can pass it along. You can get mm-hmm. you can resell it on eBay if you want. But if you want a 50% discount, then, yeah, do a read once. Why would that be reasonable?
So
would
you
that...
have examples. There actually are examples of things like that, right? Like, you agree that I'm gonna put my photocopier on your offices, and I'm gonna charge you by the page, and I got a counter in it. It's tamper resistant. My man will come to your office once a month and read the meter on your photocopier, and you'll be responsible for the consumables. You'll only buy them from me. We'll examine it to see if you've violated your contract. There's a difference, right? By and large, those are negotiated among relative economic equals, and no one has given the photocopier manufacturer a regulatory monopoly over photocopying, right? So they haven't gotten a public gift in the form of a regulatory monopoly, and so they have no public duty in the form of a duty to be fair, right? So I would love to see some copyright discussion on a legislative level about what is and isn't fair and what the duty is of someone in response for the public's largesse in the form of this regulatory monopoly that's policed at public expense.
The copyright monopoly.
And I'd love to see a future in which someone figures out how to make lawyering scale so that we can individually negotiate these contracts with these people. But I don't think either of those are particularly likely. And what we're getting instead has got the worst aspects of both systems, right? So you've got all the incursions into your world that you agree to if you're, you know, a corporate supply chain person opting for a Xerox service contract, and you've got none of the negotiating leverage that you get as an individual buying one book. So you kind of get the worst of everything. And that's not great terms for anyone. I think that's a pretty sucky future. Another important question here is not just scaling the lawyering, but scaling the enforcement. So corporations, first of all, have some risk adversity and some compliance officers who are willing to self-police and are credibly going to self-police the use of their plant, right? So if the rules say you can't load this with someone else's toner, even if you have a big brief due tomorrow, it's a law office, you have a big brief due tomorrow and you can't get toner from the main supplier, you can't go down to Staples, buy some toner and pour it into this machine, you're going to have to go to Kinko's to print your brief because we have a deal. And you've got someone who will enforce that deal, and the corporation makes a certain amount of sense through the corporation. Even though at an individual level people aren't going to do it, the corporation as a whole will likely comply. Individuals don't have anything like that, right? So what we historically do to substitute for that is we design devices so that the cop lives inside them, right? And so the cop lives inside the device, and so the device is designed to be tamper resistant, tamper evident, and to enforce policy against its owner's wishes, and sometimes without its owner's knowledge or consent, right? So like a Comcast modem now they have these terms about how you can use the network, and those terms are themselves pretty opaque, and they never actually tell you when you've run up against the limits of those terms. The modem just does stuff, and you don't even know it's doing it. It's supposed to be purely Skinnerian. You're supposed to absorb through your fingertips that your downloads have been too fast, and then just moderate your behavior on that basis, right? So the problem with designing equipment that attacks its owner, right, that allows for remote policy setting and enforcement without its owner's permission or consent, is that it violates Chekhov's first law of narrative, which is that a gun put on the mantelpiece in Act 1 is bound to go off by Act 3, or what I call the exploding spaceship problem, right? If you go to see a science fiction movie, someone always accidentally elbows the buttons on the spaceship's control panel that starts the countdown for self-destruction. And I always look at that and I think, wouldn't that be a better spaceship if it was designed not to explode, right? And we already have a spyware problem. We already have a malware problem. We already have a totalitarianism problem, right? And obviously all of those things can ride in on errors in the device, on problems with the device. But what happens when you actually design the device? So part of its specification, its normal operating procedure, is to spy on, control, and lock in or lock out users. Now, add to that the legislative infrastructure necessary to sustain it, which we've seen in the form of anti-circumvention measures in the DMCA, WIPO Copyright Treaty, Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, and so on. That legislative underpinning requires that it be unlawful to examine your device, to understand its workings, to improve on its workings, to disseminate your improvements to other people. So this question of yours, shouldn't we be able to rent a book to someone? My answer is, if renting a book to someone requires that we design totalitarianism into our device chain, should we, right? Is that a good trade? And if your answer is, oh no, we'll do it without that, we'll just do it on the honor system, I'm like, okay, if you want to do that, I don't think you'll get a lot of takers from publishing. I think a lot of people from publishing, when you say, yeah, you're going to be able to license this on a single-use basis, but the way that you're going to enforce that is you're going to say, by downloading this book, you agree that you'll delete it when you're done, but we're not going to enforce that in any way. That most publishers would go, that doesn't sound very plausible to me. I think I'm going to go for some other licensing arrangement. So, I mean, I asked, why not Wednesdays, right? Why not a licensing term that says you can only read this when you're standing on one leg on Wednesdays and if you promise to vote Republican, right? You could imagine lots and lots of limits that could be set that way. They could be pretty horrible. They wouldn't serve the progress clause, because you could, for example, have a term like Samuel Beckett's estate had on his plays, where they said women aren't allowed to appear in Beckett plays, right? Well, that's presumably within the purview of copyright. It's not within the range of first of all, you know, basic human rights legislation, and also not within the range of the Progress Clause. There's no meaningful way in which this serves the progress of the arts and sciences to say women can't participate in this area of literary endeavor or thespian endeavor. You know, that's not good policy making either. So if we're going to start rewriting copyright from the ground up, and we're going to, as a condition of that, require all this other junk that kind of rides along with it, I'd like us to explicitly say, not only are we going to make it possible to rent things, but we are also going to, from now on, build exploding spaceships and into the very fabric of the digital society. And we're going to do it because we think renting books is more important than not being spied on. And like, if that's what our social consensus emerges as, I guess I'll go along with it. But if the social consensus is, yeah, I'd like to rent a book, and I haven't thought about anything else, then let's revisit this.
So I hesitate to push back on that because it's so just wonderful to hear you express it. But I'm going to just for a moment. That assumes that between having no way of enforcing a rental agreement and having the totalitarian way of enforcing a rental agreement, there is no middle ground. And so if you want to do a rental, then, you know, you got to go full bore. Somebody else basically owns and controls your computer, reading device, whatever, which is admittedly quite unattractive. But suppose that the rental agreement said, the license you got when you got your digital material said, you no longer have the right to resell it. You can reread it, that's fine. And so there is some patrolling on eBay. And it's not going to be perfect, but you know, none of this, no, enforcement's never perfect. They patrol on eBay, and if they catch you, they'll sue you. You know, it's a contract. We don't have to have perfect enforcement in order to have licensing agreements that trade off, that you allow users to trade off some of their traditional rights in hard copy for presumably price discounts. Mm-hmm. Would those sorts of arrangements disturb you as well?
Well, I'd say that they'd fly in the face of copyright. So we already had that proposition, both books and in music, right? Where both books and music have at various times been printed with things that say, by buying this book, you acknowledge that you won't sell it to a used bookstore. And we've had booksellers and owners of books attacked under copyright law on that basis. And the courts and Congress found over and over again that wasn't copyright's intent, that it wasn't in the purview of copyright to, in the course of a sale, apply a thin veneer of license for the purposes of undermining first sale, right? You do have those agreements in place, again, in corporations where you have a negotiated agreement that's undertaken between equals for good consideration on all sides. But you don't have that in the marketplace, right, where you go into a retailer and you buy a book and you do something that walks and quacks like a purchase, except for some teeny weeny eye strain or rama on the verso that says you've just agreed that you don't own this book. I think that whatever reasons copyright found to prohibit those adhesion contracts in the past, I can't think of any reason to eschew them today. I mean, all the arguments you just made about pricing could have been just as easily applied, right? You could have had a Tower Records store, and floor one was records to resell, and floor two was records that you couldn't resell, there wouldn't be any conceptual reason you couldn't do that. But the courts never allowed rights holders to establish that regime. That was never kind of what we gave to rights holders. And I wonder again about where the consent lies. So what if you buy me a book that is licensed not for resale? Did I agree when you bought me the book not to resell it? What if I put it in my estate? Did you agree when I left it to you not to resell it? How does that consent travel, right? How does that exactly work? And I guess I'm skeptical of it. The other thing I'm skeptical of is this price discrimination business, because I haven't seen it. And in actually all the places where we're supposed to get it, like loyalty cards at Safeway, what seems to happen is just the reverse, right? What you get with Safeway is all the basic staples cost extra unless you use a loyalty card. So it's not that you get a discount for giving up your privacy. You pay a premium for maintaining it. And I think that in rental models, what we've seen by and large, now there's some exemptions like the Yahoo kind of $5 a month for all the music you want to download. But by and large, what we've seen is just the reverse, that it's a premium for ownership, not a discount for rental. No one wants to drop the price below the 99-cent iTunes threshold. They want to raise the price above the 99-cent iTunes threshold. I'm skeptical of that proposition. I'd love to, you know, if only there was a global data network that had a comprehensive history of every legal decision, we could just now stop and look up the history of book rentals and book lending and so on and see where how that netted out, because I can't remember the details. But presumably there were some pretty good reasons then. I guess I would ask, what's wrong with Carterphone then? Why do we need Carterphone or Hushaphone if there's perfectly good licensing rules that we could use? Like, why allow people to own their own phones and plug them into the wall if you can establish a regime where it's cheaper to rent people phones? Like, wouldn't the Bells eventually offer better, cheaper phones if you gave them the total and absolute control over what you could and couldn't plug into their networks? I mean, in point of fact, they didn't, right? What you ended up doing was buying the same phone 100 times once you gave them the right to monopolize what you could plug into their walls. Once you eliminated the idea that what happened in your house was your business and not the phone company's business, even though they stuck a wire in it. You know, what happens in my library is my business, even though you wrote the book or published the book. It's my book now. Yeah, I don't get to republish it, but it's mine. And what's really funny is whenever I write about this online, inevitably someone comes along and says, actually, lending a book is illegal. It's just permitted by custom. Because they've heard the simplistic copyright explanation. Copyright controls the distribution, exhibition, replication, and so on of a book. And they've reasoned from first principles, well, if that's true, then renting a book selling a book or giving away a book must be illegal. And it just must be permitted by custom. And now what computers have done is finally given us the ability to finally enforce copyright law. And it's not true. Copyright law has always taken great notice. Looping all the way back to the beginning of this, copyright law has always taken great notice of the social value of, even in the face of the monopoly that you give as a form of incentive, to carve out rights to the public. And those rights include lending, giving away, and so on.
So your new book, Makers, has its own end-user license agreement, although you don't call it that, and it's sort of an anti-EULA page, which is actually both quite wonderful and occasionally it's funny, and it's occasionally moving as well. The Woody Guthrie piece that you quote, I actually sort of choke up on every time I read it. what effect will your publishing of those terms, you might want to explain the terms, I guess, what effect do you expect it to have on your book as a commercial project?
Well, so the terms are, I mean, it's a Creative Commons license with some argument before it. So basically the argument is, I've licensed this under a Creative Commons license, and I did so for a lot of reasons. One is that you have the right to own books, and anyone who says otherwise is a jerk. And another one is that I copy my ass off all day long, and I'd be a hypocrite if I told you to stop copying. And copying is good, and copying is what makes us human. I mean, really think about it, right? 3 to 4 billion years ago, something figured out how to copy itself, and we are the result, right? You know, when my daughter was 1 week old, my mother, who is a PhD in early childhood education, flew to London to see me from Toronto, and she picked the kid up, and she said, "Have you stuck your tongue out at her yet?" And I said, "No, Mom, I haven't stuck my tongue out at my 1 week old daughter yet." And she said, "Oh, you should try." And she stuck her tongue out, and my daughter, who had never seen a mirror and had never seen her tongue, stuck her tongue out at my mom. It was like,
she's a genius.
She's a genius. All babies do this, apparently. It's copying, right? And it's copying that is built in. It's copying that is as natural as nuzzling for the breast, right? It's something that kids can do fresh out of the wrapper. So telling people that copying is wrong and exalting some kind of fictional bourgeois originality in which everyone invents everything every time they sit down to create a new work is so totally corrosive. Right? I just gave a talk at this literacy strategy thing in Toronto where I said, you know, we've got these like copyright organizations that supposedly represent writers that produce material for classrooms. And the materials say you have to be original whenever you write. And I don't know a single writer who started off that way, right? If you told me when I was six and I wrote my first story and it was Star Wars, I'd just seen Star Wars. It's 1977. I went home. I took some paper. I trimmed it to paperback size. I stapled it up the side and I wrote out Star Wars and I practiced Star Wars. I did it for a year. I wrote out Star Wars in all its variations, trying to get my head around how Star Wars worked. If you had told me when I was six that I wasn't allowed to do that, that that wasn't real writing, I wouldn't be a writer today. It is the most corrosive, horrible, corrupting, hypocritical lie to tell kids. So that's also part of the argument. And then the other part of the argument is, you know, copy away, tell your friends if you like it. I'm betting that you'll buy the book today because today books are not replaced by electronic books. They're enhanced by electronic books. Nobody wants to read a whole book off a screen. And if tomorrow that changes, well, hell, I'll think of something then. But, you know, I'm going to make hay while the sun's shining. I'm not going to stand in front of my typewriter with my arms folded and say no ebooks for you until, you know, the world rearranges itself to my convenience, right? I mean, you know, in addition to being an artist, I'm an entrepreneur, right? I need some money today, not you know, the promise of money tomorrow. Jam yesterday, jam tomorrow, no jam today, right? I want to get paid today, and here's an opportunity. I'm going to seize it rather than calling my readers thieves and then hoping that in 10 years I'll have figured out a way to get money from them after calling them thieves for a decade. So that's more or less the argument. And does it work? Well, it's hard to know for sure, right? There's no empirical way I can prove it because I don't have other books that I can read, that I can publish simultaneous that are in all other ways identical except for having the Creative Commons license and then match the sales for sales. But like Little Brother, which is my last novel, which is the one that I've got pretty good numbers for, 90,000 hardcovers in print in the US and Canada. British edition in addition to that, and then 16 other foreign editions in various languages, film rights sold to the guy who made Transformers, audiobooks from Random House Audio, game and comic book rights under negotiation. I just got a giant royalty check for it, you know, because as you know, royalty checks take forever to come in because there's all that withholding. But like another one like that, I won't have a mortgage anymore, right? So is it working? Well, I don't know. Maybe I would have gotten five times as much money if it wasn't for the Creative Commons license. But at least I'm not starving. And so like to be able to not starve, in fact, to be able to enjoy a very nice, comfortable middle-class existence in London of all places, and in addition, not be a hypocrite, and in addition, enjoy, I haven't mentioned the artistic benefit to me, which is that, you know, here it's the 21st century, copying's only getting easier. You know, anyone who thinks otherwise is like dreaming, right? It's not like hard drives are going to get less capacious, bulkier, and more expensive, or, you know, fewer people are going to know how to type Batman Returns BitTorrent into Google, or, you know, networks are going to get more expensive and harder to access, or computers are going to get more expensive and our general expertise in them will fall off, right? I mean, from now on, copying gets easier, right? So if you're making art that you don't intend to have copied in the 21st century, it may be lovely and anachronistic, like being the blacksmith at Pioneer Village, but it's hardly contemporary, right? And here I am, I'm a contemporary artist. I'm writing science fiction, for God's sake, right? And if that's not at least contemporary, then, you know, what is, right? Maybe if I was writing medieval fantasy, extruded Tolkien product, right? That would be different. But I am writing science fiction, and if it's not contemporary, how does it have any credibility? You know, doesn't it make good artistic sense to make 21st century art about the 21st century that can be copied using the 21st century signature medium, right? Isn't that good art? So I get all of those benefits. So yeah, it makes sense commercially, probably. It certainly isn't killing me commercially. And all that other stuff accrues to me as a result of doing it. And it makes me a happy man.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Cory Doctorow is author of Little Brother, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, and the recently released book Makers. You can find his musings posted almost daily at boingboing.net. And if you want to find out more about Cory, maybe even download his new book for absolutely free, you can visit our website at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you.